From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. North Korea is on a major tear lately of threats and war talk. South Korea's talking tough, too. The U.S. isn't exactly hiding out. All kinds of super lethal U.S. aircraft have been swooping over the Korean Peninsula. This is not a new dance, but is it different this time? North Korea has threatened the U.S. mainland with nuclear attack. They've been testing missiles. This hour on Point, North Korea's war threats go ballistic. We'll look at what's going on. You can join the conversation. Is there something new here? Something different? Something dangerous? How dangerous? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Friday, hear sound of thousands of North Korean soldiers and students marching through Kim Il-sung Square in downtown Pyongyang, supporting Kim Jong-un's call to arms against South Korea and the U.S., chanting, "Sweep away the U.S. aggressors and death to the U.S. imperialists." There has been plenty of that. Then, yesterday, South Korea's president, Park Geun-hye, told the South Korean Ministry of Defense that the country's armed forces should respond as they see fit. Here she is. You'll hear her say, "Don't worry about the politics of it. If we're attacked, hit back." She's interpreted here by AFP.
"I believe that we should make a strong and immediate retaliation without any political considerations if the North stages any provocation against our people. As Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, I would trust the military's judgment on any sudden and surprise provocations by North Korea, as it is the one that directly faces off against the North."
Trust the military's judgment, says the president of South Korea. Yesterday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said the U.S. is taking action to support South Korea to prevent an escalation in tension. Of course, that's involved a lot of very sophisticated U.S. aircraft over the region.
"The actions we've taken are prudent, and they include on missile defense to enhance both the homeland and allied security, and other actions like the B-2 and B-52 flights have been important steps to reassure our allies, demonstrate our resolve to the North, and reduce pressure on Seoul to take unilateral action. And we believe this has reduced the chance of miscalculation and provocation."
The mood on the street in Seoul, where we'll go in just a few seconds, we'll ask, but here was one young Korean, South Korean, talking on NBC Nightly News. He said he thinks North Korea is bluffing and South Korea is fine because the U.S. has their back.
I really don't think people are thinking that they're going to come and actually attack us because, you know, America has our back.
And maybe he's right, but here on the streets in North Korean state television, here's a North Korean woman saying Kim Jong-un is preparing his people for the possibility of war. Here she is, interpreted by CNN.
"Kim Jong-un says if the war breaks out, we should mercilessly crush our enemies," this woman said. "Crush them so they wouldn't even be able to sign the surrender papers."
Lots of talk. And then today, news that North Korea is restarting, says it will restart its nuclear reactor at Yongbon, north of Pyongyang. Joining us first today from Seoul, South Korea, is Alistair Gale, bureau chief there for the Wall Street Journal. Alistair Gale, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Any sign of this cooling down, or is it still ratcheting up? You've got the UN Secretary General saying, you know, it's not a game talking about nuclear war. Let's cool out. But is that happening, Alistair?
Well, certainly the war rhetoric has, we haven't seen any of that today. But, you know, we've got a new direction with North Korea's announcement that it's going to restart this nuclear reactor. So, you know, it's not cooling down, but it's kind of heading in another direction. Certainly this is... you know, threatening development. So the North talks about wanting to produce more plutonium for, you know, warheads. It said that its nuclear program now is non-negotiable, and that's something that it intends to ramp up. So, you know, its posture hasn't changed, but, you know, the rhetoric has kind of moved in a different direction.
What about the South Korean readiness this time to hit back? How has their policy changed? Of course, there have been strikes in the past, but are they ready to do something more this time if North Koreans do something?
Sure. This goes back to 2010, where there were two attacks here in South Korea that killed 50 South Koreans. The North Koreans sank a warship, and they also bombed an island. And after the island attack, the response from the South Koreans was universally viewed here as being too weak and too slow. There were a few, the artillery unit on the island that was attacked did fire back, but not for some time after the North Koreans had hit them. And the consensus view was that they couldn't do enough. So really that was the turning point here. And following that, the defense minister resigned. And there was a more of a willingness, and you feel it here amongst the public as well, that more needs to be done against North Korea. You know, the South Koreans, the view here is kind of, we've taken this for a long time, you know, 50, 60 years since the end of the Korean War. There's been various North Korean provocations, and the South Koreans have kind of looked to kind of take the heat out of the situation. But they are feeling now that, you know, if something does happen, if the North Koreans do start something new, they want to go in much harder this time. And that's obviously something that concerns the U.S., and I think that is one of the reasons the U.S. has, you know, had this display of force recently, because the risk really here is that if the North Korea miscalculates and stages some kind of, you know, minor incursion even, that the South will go back in with disproportionate force, and then this whole thing will escalate. So that's the real concern here.
What is American policy if the North hits out and the South hits back? Is the United States prepared? Is it committed to joining the South in that counterpunch?
Well, the South Korea and the U.S. signed an agreement really recently, which meant the terms of the agreement were not actually spelled out, but it was basically saying that the U.S. would work with South Korea in any response to a North Korean attack. Now, you have to assume that that means that the U.S. would get involved at some point. Exactly at what point, we don't know, but there is a commitment there that the U.S. would have South Korea's back, and it would be involved in any kind of retaliation against the North. And I would imagine, particularly at the point where if it escalates, that's the point where the U.S. would almost certainly step in.
Significant stakes, including for the United States. Alistair Gale, South Korea Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones Newswires. Thank you very much for being with us, Alistair.
Thanks, Tom.
We're going to hear in a few minutes from the man who was commander U.S. forces on the Korean Peninsula until very recently. Joining us right now from Seoul in South Korea is John DeLury, assistant professor of East Asian Studies at Yonsei University's Graduate School of International Studies. John DeLury, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What's your interpretation of what's going on here? Why this is an old cycle of threat and sometimes strike, but relatively minor. This time the rhetoric seems higher and hotter than ever and seems to be going on longer and further. What do you see happening here, John?
Yeah, well, it's a familiar cycle, but it's in changed circumstances, new circumstances. You know, one of the most obvious is that we have new leadership. Of course, in North Korea with Kim Jong-un, so many of the question marks are about what can we expect from him as a leader and the people around him, and that's something we should talk about because there have been some important changes in their senior leadership just over the last couple of days. But then, of course, there's a new president here in South Korea who's so far having a difficult time just domestically getting her footing. Meanwhile, she has to deal with this intense and escalating, at least rhetorically escalating, conflict with the North. And then we have, you know, let's not forget about in China, we have Xi Jinping, who's brand new to his office. And we have a new prime minister in Japan, in Shinzo Abe. So that right there creates a whole new set of dynamics where we have very complicated politics, and the relationships between all these people is really not established. So that's contributing to the instability.
Could we speak to one just practical issue here? Americans have seen lots of reports in recent months about North Korean missile tests, long-range missiles, and also about North Korean nuclear tests. And North Korea has threatened, there's a lot of rhetoric that comes out of Pyongyang, but they've threatened to turn South Korea and Washington into a sea of fire, to hit the U.S. mainland in a nuclear attack. Do they, in fact, have anything like that capacity or not, John?
Well, when you talk about missiles, the long-range missiles are satellite tests, and they did have a relatively successful three-stage satellite launch. They were able to send something up into space. Now, to have a successful ballistic missile even test, and certainly to actually launch a ballistic missile at another country, there's a lot more involved where you have to hit something back on Earth, not just shoot it into orbit, into space. And then in terms of on the nuclear side, they had a third test We still don't know a lot of information about that test, but it seems to have been more successful than the previous two ones. So they seem to be improving their capabilities with some kind of controlled nuclear device explosion. But then there's a lot of steps between that and successful miniaturization and putting it on a warhead and all of that. So, you know, it's not like they have the capability to launch a nuclear attack on Washington now. But, you know, when you look at a 3, 5, 10 year span, their capabilities are certainly progressing, and that's why that's contributing to the concern.
What about their potential capacity to hit Japan or U.S. bases in the Pacific, John?
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I'm here in Seoul. I'm not far from short-range missile capabilities, and Japan is within reach for medium range, although notably there's not been a lot of rhetoric directed against Japan in this most recent cycle. It's really been focused on the United States and secondarily on South Korea. But yeah, they have all kinds of short and mid-range missile capabilities that don't even need testing. I mean, those are pretty much ready to go.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about high tension and threats out of North Korea, what they mean, and where it could all go this time. What is the real threat to the region and, for that matter, to the U.S.? Here's a video from North Korea State Television. A member of the North Korean defense sport team practices military exercises which include shouting. He's saying the U.S. warmongers, South Korean puppets, and their followers should realize we will hold our weapons high and run to the South Korean territory to smash them, sweep off the enemies when they disturb our dignity and bring on a war. Well, okay, the other side of the Pacific, here's Chuck Hagel, U.S. Defense Secretary, on Thursday, saying they're paying close attention to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
We have to take seriously every provocative, bellicose word and action that this new young leader has taken so far since he's come to power.
The White House yesterday trying to cool things down a little bit. Here's Press Secretary Jay Carney.
Despite the harsh rhetoric we're hearing from Pyongyang, we are not seeing changes to the North Korean military posture, such as large-scale mobilizations and positioning of forces.
John DeLore is with us from Yonsei University in Seoul, South Korea. And with us right now from Athens, Georgia, is Han Park, professor of international affairs, director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at the University of Georgia, author of North Korea, The Politics of Unconventional Wisdom. He went to North Korea in 2009 to negotiate the release of Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, two American journalists who had been arrested for crossing the North Korean border. Han Park, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Is it different this time?
Yes, I think this time is distinctly different. Kim Jong-un is a different kind of leader in that he knows the West fairly well. He spent some years in Switzerland when he was much younger. And also he found out upon assuming the leadership that there is no way that the country can promote economic growth without taking care of defense architecture. That is, as long as the status quo, which is sanction upon sanction, and this limbo continues, then North Korea will have no way of promoting economic growth. So this time he's saying that we either make a full-blown peace arrangement with the United States and South Korea and Japan. That's actually what he wants and his party wants. But this limbo is not a possibility. Now that for the first time in 60 years, we have the weaponry, including nuclear capability, now we can defend ourselves. We can be a formidable military force.
You're saying North Korea is saying this, and the sanctions you're talking about, Western sanctions against
exactly.
North Korea, because of that nuclear program. So,
right. Yes.
But I don't hear anybody talking about peace talks here. All the talk is about the risk of this escalating into conflict.
Yeah, that's the problem with the Western governments and experts. The problem is that we really don't know much about North Korea on the ground, and we don't seem to have that keen interest either. So we always look at North Korea with the Western lenses, which is incorrect. North Korea, most recently, even this turmoil, the prime minister is replaced the other day. He is an economic bureaucrat specializing in China. So they know that they have to promote the economy. Otherwise, there's no future. So in order to do that, they have to cut the defense cost. They have to do away with the military preparation. One thing that we don't understand is that North Korea wants security architecture established. Then the military, the nuclear weapons is really subject to negotiation. They're prepared to give up their nuclear weapons. I didn't see Kim Jong-un himself, but I talked to any number of party key officials, including Politburo members, just last year. And North Korea is not dictated by Kim Jong-un, 29-year-old man who doesn't know the world and so forth. It is the Communist Party. It's the Korea Labor Party that is in firm control. The party members are well experienced, well versed in international affairs. So it is certain that they want economic growth. For that, they need to have a peace agreement with the United States and perhaps diplomatic normalization with the United States. That's what they want.
It seems like we're headed in just the opposite direction. I want to come back and look at how that might unfold. That would be great if we could get there. Han Park, please stand by in Athens, Georgia, and John DeLury in Seoul, South Korea. With us as well right now from Washington is General Walter Sharp, retired four-star general. He was commander of U.S. Forces Korea from 2008 to 2011, former director of the Joint Staff from 05 to 08. General Sharp, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
You hear Han Park there saying what North Korea really wants is peace, maybe normalization of relations. In the meantime, we're seeing a lot of threats. We've seen a lot of U.S. aircraft flying over there, even all the way from Missouri, big bombers. What do you make of this standoff? You've been on the front line in this, in a command position. Does this look more dangerous to you than similar past moments, General?
It does. I believe this is different from three perspectives. First off is Kim Jong-un has seen what has been successful over many decades of this same cycle of provocations and then asking for aid, then going back through provocations. Mm-hmm. But now he also sees that the world's just not going to give him things like has been done in the past. So I believe that he is trying to push the limit to see what external audiences will stand for before they give and are willing to sit down and talk to him. Secondly, from an internal perspective, I think it's different. Remember, last year, 2012, was supposed to be the year of a great and powerful and successful North Korea. He and his father have not delivered on that. There is more and more information slowly getting into North Korea. So some of this is for internal consumption to try to shore up support of his people in North Korea. And then third is the response that will come back from any sort of provocation or attack by North Korea. And I am convinced that it will be a very fast, swift, and powerful response by the Republic of Korea, and then a very strong alliance response to take something that is of value and hold it at risk for Kim Jong-un. So I do believe it's different from those perspectives. I don't believe that Kim Jong-un is willing to give up his nuclear weapons under any circumstance. I believe all he cares about is regime survival, and he sees those nuclear weapons as regime survival.
General, if I may ask, what kind of response? We hope it doesn't come to that at all. Let's simmer down here. I think the U.N. Secretary General, I think he's got it right. But if North Korea should hit the South again, as it has in the past, and the South is saying we don't want a proportionate response this time, potentially we want a very, as you say, fast, swift, and powerful response. Like what? I mean, I'm reading in the South Korean press, they're talking about just blowing up some gigantic statues of Kim Song-il and Kim Jong-un's predecessors as leaders of Korea. Are we talking blowing up statues or something else?
Well, first off, the immediate response, the self-defense response that comes back will be very quickly from South Korea. Keep in mind, South Korea is the one that's on the border today. They're in the air patrolling 24 hours a day mm-hmm. and out at sea. And they have practiced and rehearsed since November of 2010 what the response will be to, in self-defense, very, very quickly come back and strike very hard into North Korea. And then also over that time period, both countries, the United States and the Republic of Korea, have developed this counter-provocation plan, which you've heard was signed by General Thurman and General Jung just mm-hmm. recently. Mm-hmm. And in that counter-provocation plan, I've not seen it, but I'm fairly confident what is in there is an agreed-to set of circumstances of bringing in the alliance to a response after an attack. That will be decisions made either by the presidents of our two countries or the secretaries of defense. I'm not sure where it's been delegated to, but at very high level as to what is the next level of response. But I also think that that kind of provocation plan has two other elements in it. First is mechanisms to control escalation. Nobody wants this to escalate into all-out war. And how we will try to control escalations, I'm sure, is also well thought out in the plan. And then the third part is we always have to be prepared if Kim Jong-un decides to go to war. So the actions we take in reaction to an attack and how we control escalations also have to allow us to be able to seamlessly and very quickly transition into war or instability. So it's those balances that I'm very confident that this plan has worked its way through, and it will be an alliance response if there's another attack like there were in 2010.
Alliance meaning the United States, first of all. I mean, hope it comes to none of this. But when you say that South Korea would immediately strike back very hard, against what? I mean, I don't mean exactly you were commander there. I don't mean to give anything away. But what sort of thing? Against something in Pyongyang, like the capital city or some facilities? Yongbyon, the nuclear reactor?
Well, again, I think the immediate response by South Korea will be very strong against what is attacking South Korea.
I see.
And the forces that are controlling that, the sources of the provocation, the sources of the attack. And then I'm confident that there will be very quick and already thought through menu, if you will, of options for the Republic of Korea-U.S. alliance to determine should there be next steps to punish Kim Jong-un for his decisions to attack and kill South Koreans.
How do you control escalation? How does that happen? I mean, look at the Korean War. You know, we didn't know what was going to happen, and suddenly it was gigantic. How do you actually do that, General?
Well, it's a combination of, I think, diplomatic pressure and having sources not just directly between South Korea and the United States talking to North Korea, though we really want to set those mechanisms up, but also other mechanisms through third countries to tell North Korea to stand down. But the other part of escalation control is to show might, show strength, that if he does escalate this, we are prepared for any sort of escalatory actions as an alliance.
Han Park, here's Tom, a general whose successor is now, you know, in charge of U.S. forces in Korea. You're talking about North Korea wanting peace, but we can easily imagine when you listen to this how easily it could go the other way.
Yes, let me interject here,
please.
Let's visualize the unthinkable. Say we had a war, all out war, so to speak. North Koreans, they
terrible,
have the ability.
Terrible.
Yes, it's unthinkable.
Seoul is so close to the border. You've got everything
absolutely
on the line.
Tom, you got it right. Where do we strike in North Korea? Or statues, buildings? One has to realize that 2 million Pyongyang citizens can hide underground, 100 meters deep, and which is the subway system in Pyongyang, which will accommodate everyone in Seoul. And every town in North Korea has bomb shelters, deep, at least 50 meters deep, and I was told. And then I visited some of these. I used the subway system myself. Now, if we attacked Pyongyang was attacked during the Korean War, became an ashes. Mm-hmm. So now they have built this subway system as a bomb shelter. Last 60 years plus, they have been preparing to be attacked. Look at South Korea. Everything is exposed. You have 12 million people living there. The subway system there is not really 5 meters deep.
So why are we even talking about armed conflict then?
That is a really, you know, North Koreans. And one thing I'm so worried about right now is this. Kim Jong-un created an environment where he may have to do something. I think he made a mistake by cornering himself, by using his own words. Previous leaders, they saved their own involvement in the final decisions. But Kim Jong-un came out and
publicly
detailed this, discussed, you know,
so his reputation
detail
is on the line here. Let me get a caller right here, if I may. John, calling from Kittery, Maine. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I was wondering, rather than allow this regime to continue on with its nuclear proliferation and ballistic missile capabilities, because one day they will have the capability to do that, rather than allow them to go on any further, I believe that we'd be better off to attack them right now and remove that capability from their hand. And, yeah, that would start a war, but we're going to have this war anyhow, and they're going to have it 5 years from now when they actually have a missile. Ain't it better to have one today than then?
John, let us pick it up. General, what do you say to that perspective from John?
Well, first off, I think that a war would be devastating to this entire region, and because of the location of Seoul, as the professor pointed out, it would be very deadly. There's no doubt that South Korea and the United States would win that war, but there would be huge deaths. I believe, and I also agree with a caller, that the longer this stretches out, the more dangerous North Korea gets. That's what Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un, especially Kim Jong-il, has done over the past decades. He has allowed the cycle to continue so that he could have the time to develop ballistic missiles and a nuclear capability. So what I believe that we ought to push for is to get information into the people of North Korea, to start changing this internally. They are so isolated in North Korea, but there are ways to get information into Korea to just talk about human rights, about freedom, about democracy. You know, if you take a look at what Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un have been doing to their people, it's obvious that all they care about is their regime. Hundreds of thousands of people in concentration camps, no ability for people to leave the country, 25% of their children malnutrition, deaths from malnutrition every year, no human rights whatsoever. We need to start informing the people of North Korea so that they, the people, can start to try to force a change of the regime in North Korea.
General Walter Sharp, he was commander U.S. forces on the Korean Peninsula until 2011. General Sharp, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
John DeLury, what can the U.S. do to ratchet down the tension here, to get to the even to a peace conversation, if that's what Kim Jong-un might want?
Well, I mean, the first step is you have to talk to your adversary, and this has been the most fundamental error, really, of the Obama administration first-term policy toward North Korea, is the almost total absence of dialogue. You know, in the Clinton administration, our diplomats spent hundreds and hundreds of hours with North Koreans visiting Pyongyang or holding talks in Geneva and other parts of the world. And even the George W. Bush administration, by the end, had come around and realized you have to talk to these guys. And in fact, you can make deals with them. They will carry out pledges when the agreement is very carefully constructed.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about high tension and threats out of North Korea, what they mean and where it could go this time. What is the real threat to the region, to the U.S.? What's moving North Korea? What's moving the other side? John DeLury joins us from Yonsei University's Graduate School of International Studies in Seoul, South Korea, just, 30, 40 miles from the border with North Korea. Han Park is with us from Athens, Georgia. He's at the University of Georgia in the Center for the Study of Global Issues there. He traveled to North Korea in 2009 to help negotiate the release of Americans Laura Ling and Yuna Lee. It can sound pretty scary, but the news reports out of South Korea show South Koreans right on the border there pretty calm. Here's a South Korean woman interviewed by CNN's Jim Clancy on Sunday, interpreted by CNN.
전쟁이 날 것 같진 않아요. I don't think there will be a war. Currently, North Korea just raised up their military alertness. South Korean people are not even interested.
Not even interested. So how bad can it be? John DeLurie, we've seen this widely reported that South Koreans are not that head up about what's going on. Does that mean the rest of the world is, you know, is not cool enough about this?
Well, no. I think a lot of these man in the street interviews are very misleading. Journalists come in, they stick a camera in the face of someone walking downtown Seoul and say, "Are you worried about war?" You're not going to really understand the complexity of how South Koreans are experiencing what's going on. I'm living here and have a lot of South Korean friends and family members, and there's clearly everyone is feeling a different level of anxiety for the reasons we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But probably if you put a camera in their face, that's not what they're going to say. So I think, you know, we need to contextualize a lot of that. But I want to go back to the question you raised about what can be done, in particular, what can the United States and what can the South Korean governments do? Because we desperately need to change the dynamics here, and we need to get out of this cycle, even if it's rhetorical, of essentially bluster. It's really bluster on both sides, right? Mm. I mean, the United States is flying F-22s and B-52s and B-2s and showing off its hardware. South Korea is talking about bombing statues, as you've described. So we need to give Kim Jong-un a face-saving way to back down. And that's very hard to swallow that pill because, as General Sharp, you know, as a military man, that's not what he wants to do right now. But diplomatically, that's what we need to do.
What could we offer? What could South Korea or the United States offer as a face-saving path?
Well, over the weekend, Kim Jong-un and the Central Committee had a very high-level, important meeting in which they announced what they called as a new strategic line. And what that strategic line was, two things. We're not giving up our nuclear weapon. That's not new. But secondly, they said, we are still committed to economic development. So we need to pick up on that piece of economic development. China has a key role here. China needs to invite the new premier, a gentleman named Park Peng-ju, who's a technocrat, a pragmatist. He's been to China. He's been to South Korea. He's someone we can work with. We need to embrace him. We need to give him political capital. We need to start to use economics to change the fundamental dynamics in this relationship. And there's a second thing that North Korea said recently. They said, we're not giving up our nuclear weapons until everyone gives up their nuclear weapons. But they said, we will make positive efforts to contribute to nuclear safety and nonproliferation. That's a relatively new, that's certainly a new emphasis.
Mm-hmm.
And in my own talks with North Korean officials and visits, I was in North Korea in January, you know, that's not something they usually talk about. They talk about the risk of proliferation. But here Kim Jong-un said, I want to make positive efforts to nonproliferation. The United States needs to pick up on that, needs to test that, needs to say, okay, denuclearization is down the road, but let's work on counterproliteration.
That sounds good. Do you see, John, like Han Park sees, behind all this current very hot talk, a desire in the North for peace, for some truly new dynamic of interaction in Kim Jong-un? Or is that, I don't know, do you see that, John?
Yeah, absolutely. Unmistakable. We miss it because we are so obsessed with the nuclear issue that we don't pay attention to what's going on domestically. We don't look at the other speeches Kim Jong-un is giving in which he's emphasizing these economic things, themes. He's making promises. The most kind of vivid one is he's made promises multiple times. He said to the North Korean people, I will not make you tighten your belts again. Most recently, he has said something that one Korea expert, Bob Carlin, calls the nuclear dividend. He said, now that we have a nuclear deterrent, we can stop spending so much on defense and invest more in our economy. This is stuff that's coming out of North Korean state media. So, you know, this is not an ideal world, but that's what we have to work with to encourage some more moderate, pragmatic trends here and get ourselves out of this current escalatory cycle, which is incredibly dangerous for South Korea. But, I mean, this would, the kind of scenario we're talking about here,
unthinkable.
And the wartime scenario that General Sharp talked about, I mean, you know, I live here, so obviously I care personally, but if all you care about is the global economy, this would be devastating for the global economy. Think about all your Samsung products. There they go.
Yeah.
So this is not just a local Korean issue. This is a global issue.
Not to mention all the lives. Han Park, for a lot of Americans, I'm sure, would like to avoid all of that. And yet North Korea can look, it can look from the U.S. like it's blackmailing. You know, it blusters, it raises the stakes higher and higher. And then John suggesting some outreach to help them with economic development. It can look like blackmail. Is there a real path toward a new relationship here, Han Park?
No, I completely agree with John. Time for sanctions upon sanctions has passed, because sanctions will not work. And the key issue is North Koreans want, like any other sovereign state, their security established first, national security. When national security is being threatened, or at least perceived to be threatened, then we cannot expect the human rights. We cannot expect anything. So we've got to visit their concern of security through peace talk, peace agreement, and so forth. And then North Korea does not have the desire to keep their nuclear ambition because they have the science, they have the technology, they have the scientists, they have the raw material. They can start anytime if a situation dictates. It's not that big deal for them to give up, quote unquote, their nuclear ambition at this time. Now, I like to observe one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, who is responsible for all that behind the scene? I think we have to look at the military-industrial complex.
Where?
Not only in the United States, beginning with that, and in South Korea as well. So who is providing the rationale for missile defense system and scores of development weapons? North Korea is a very important scapegoat for the missile defense program.
And we've just outlined a big expansion of our missile defense system.
Exactly. $1 billion, that's North Korea. And then not many people realize, so when you look at the data source, South Korea currently is the largest purchaser in the world of U.S. weapons. So now your military industry, economy here, interest here, having North Korea, South Korea stalemate like that is just fine to them. So it is so important for us to neutralize these underlying forces that facilitate this kind of turmoil.
May I put that to you?
Yeah,
John, how does
sure.
that sound to you? I mean, that is very far from the way this typically comes across in the Western media. Sort of South Korea and the West, I don't know, this being kind of puppeteered by, you know, the lords of industry who like the returns?
Well, let me add another kind of comparative figure to frame this. The standard estimate is that South Korea spends annually on defense the entire size of the North Korean GDP. So, you know, we focus on the threat and the bluster. Part of what's going on here is North Korea, a very poor country of 24 million people, has to bluster, and at this stage has to, and from its perspective and its basic security, says, thank God we have a nuclear deterrent, because otherwise we are completely outclassed, outspent by South Korea, which is then backed by the world's only superpower. So the asymmetry here, in terms of the raw capabilities, is overwhelming.
Well, I mean, you say only superpower, but we saw the Korean War, and China, superpower or not, was right there behind the North. Let me go to Glenn in Woodbury, Tennessee. Glenn, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I married a Korean girl.
Great.
And she said, you know, you guys just stopped. She used the expression "in your own convenience." You just stopped the war in your own convenience. And I feel so bad about those people. They've had a war for over 50 years. Every kid, every male kid, is drafted and goes there. There have been skirmishes on that.
An absence of peace, anyway. So what about now, Glenn?
Now they're just doing extortion again. It's extortion. They're shaking us down. They mentioned this morning that the nuclear power plant that they're going to reactivate was one that we paid them to be able to deactivate before.
Yeah.
I don't know what president was, whether it was Bush or whatever, but it sounds like Bush.
Yeah.
But it's just extortion. They're trying to get money out of us. They're rattling the sword, and the last time they did it, we just paid them to shut up.
It was 2007.
What we need to do is the German model, and just just do PR in North Korea, and they can do reunification, and instead of spending all their money on military, just as the West Germans had to sort of carry the East Germans, and they still do, I suppose, South Korea can carry North Korea, but at least they could be eating.
I mean, that sounds great if we could get to it, but getting to it looks like a big challenge. Let me hold that the German model idea. I'll take it to my guests. That's interesting. Let me go first, if I may, to Joseph in Attle, Massachusetts. Joseph, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that they said the German method. No one in East Germany, except the government, wanted to blow up anybody in West Germany, which is why the people work so well together, and I don't think you'll have that in Korea.
Hmm.
My problem is I don't think we have any transparency. I think we need to try something that's never been done before. Just say, if you do this, this will follow. Not a vague kind of generalization, but a very specific, if you don't stop now, we're going to blow up your reactor. Here's the day we're going to blow it up. Here's the time we're going to blow it up. Here's what we're going to do to it. Quit being covert about this. This is what got us into World War I. This is what created the opportunities for World War II. When we have no clarity, we have what we've achieved over the last 40 years of our relationship with North Korea could best be described in two words: epic fail. It's because we don't say what we mean, and we rarely, if ever, seem to mean what we say.
Well, yeah, there's all kinds of clarity. Clarity, I suppose, on the threat side, but I don't know about clarity on the upside of the peace side as well. John, pick up those. Number one, on clarity. Can the U.S. have real clarity with North Korea? Because, I mean, maybe the U.S. is not prepared to just peacefully accept forever a Stalinist regime there. And what about the German model? Is there a path by which North Korea and South could get to that model? There's been a lot of talk about sunshine policy in the last 20 years, but we haven't seen any German parallel emerge.
On the first point, I mean, I think there's something to what the caller's saying that, I mean, clarity is one way of putting it. You know, it's often discussed as red lines. There need to be clear red lines and then consequences. And I would sort of caution the caller to, you know, when you set that red line as if you continue your nuclear program, we're going to start bombing you. Are we actually prepared to carry out that red line? Because, you know, that's an act of war, and then North Korea will start bombing the South. So that the caller is essentially actually asking for an onset of another Korean War. So I'm not sure it really. I think the principle is right. I think that particular application of it is not going to work. So
mm-hmm.
Well.
Han Park, yeah. What about the German model? Could that emerge here? South Korea has the wealth to support the North, but could we possibly get to that cooperation?
No, German model is not going to happen. It's not applicable.
Why?
South Korea is much too weak in terms of its economy and so forth in comparison with West Germany was. And North Korea is much too big, much too strong than East Germany was. And then any kind of hasty integration may create significant social unrest and political turmoil. What is needed is for the Korean Peninsula, let them develop their own pathway toward eventual reunification. I think early 2000, two presidents, North and South Korea, got together, agreed to have so-called the 615 agreement, in which they agreed to set up a sort of confederate system where two systems' ideology will be intact, but they have a joint kind of managerial entity. I think that's what they need to do and create a model of its own. That is this Korean model. So without it, you know, if you're thinking about one side absorbing the other, the future is not there. There will be war.
How could we ratchet down the tension right now without just fueling a worse conflict down the road?
Yes. Right now, diplomacy negotiation should be quiet, should be underwater. That is track two or whatever, underwater. Because when these things are revealed, Then they have a face-saving situation, domestic politics and all that. All countries are like that. So we need to establish informal, unofficial contact with North Koreans. That's what North Korea wants. But we are not giving it because it's a bad guy. We don't want to reward the bad behavior. And I think that concept is antiquity. We have to move on toward the future. The situation has changed. As John pointed out, we have all these surrounding countries' political arrangements have been altered. So we have to look at new future.
Well, the present is attention-grabbing enough, but we always have to look through it. Han Park, you've helped us do that today from the University of Georgia's Center for the Study of Global Issues. Han Park, thank you very much for joining us again on Point.
Thank you for having me here.
And John Delury, Assistant Professor East Asian Studies at Yonsei University's Graduate School of International Studies in Seoul, South Korea, not far from that demilitarized zone. John, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, in this hour tomorrow, we're going to look at the White House big new plan for mapping the inner workings of the human brain. Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.